Our next guest, let me tell you this, I'm very excited for him. He is our economic guru. You know, I've named him our economic guru. He is with the Bonson Group, and let me just get ready. He's early. You got to love people that are early, right? I mean, they're early. You know, they're here. You all know me. I have a reputation of not being early. So let me get him up real quick. And AW will just have to wait then if we don't have him here. But let's get David Bonson on the line. David, are you there?
I am. I didn't know I was early. This is my calendar. I'm just doing what it says.
Yeah. That's okay. That just means we have more time together. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. David Bonson, you know, I appreciate you coming back on the show. I named you my economic guru because you know a lot and you have a new book out and I'm excited about it. Can you give our listeners here, describe the book because, and especially have your ears perk up if you like investing because David's book is really going to help you out. David.
Well, I'm going to tell you all about my new book, but I will say I'm a little scared of the idea of anyone who has a book coming out becoming an economic guru because there's a lot of people out there that have written some books that do not make them a guru. They make them a quack.
A quack.
A quack. No shortage of economic quacks out there. And I guess that's why I'm on Earth is to try to counteract the economic quacks. No, the book is called The Case for Dividend Growth Investing in a Post-Crisis World. And so it basically is the argument I'm making for how an investor ought to think about and approach being invested in things like stocks and you know, companies.
Yeah.
Since the financial crisis, we're now 10 years past it. We've had this really strong decade in stocks recovering from the crisis. Prior to that, we had this really atrocious decade with the financial crisis and the dot-com crash. And now my question is, where do we go from here? And my answer is, we go back to what stock investing is supposed to always have been about, and that is companies making profits, that they share those profits with you. And that's what dividend growth is all about.
So, in the very first, I believe it was the first chapter, you talk about how great the 90s were. Right, because you know it was a great time to be investing. Everybody saw some pretty good yields. Do you think we're headed back into that direction? Is it getting better? Is it getting better? Who's to credit? Is it a political thing? Is Trump to credit?
Well, there's two different questions there. So let me tackle the first one. I sure hope we're not going back to a period like the second half of the 1990s. On one hand, 95, 96, 97, you really did have great innovation, great technological expansion. The economy was doing well. The budget was balanced. You had the Newt Gingrich Congress and the Bill Clinton White House. Back then, that's when Democrats were sane, and they believed in a strong dollar. They believed in balanced budgets. There was kind of a different economic worldview there was a guy named Robert Rubin was Treasury Secretary at the time. And so it was just kind of a different world economically and politically. But we know how it ended when the market kept going higher. And then 1998 was big. And then 1999 was really, really big. And then all these technology companies, and you remember pets.com and these companies that had never made a dollar, you know, we're trading at $150 a share and hundreds of billions of dollars was wiped away when eventually all those companies blew up. So I'm a big believer in growing companies and growing stock prices and investors being sensible, but I'm certainly not a big believer in trying to catch a bubble. And that's what the late 90s proved to be.
Yeah.
So the answer is no, I hope we're not going back there in that sense, but I do hope we're going back to, you know, consistent economic growth. And that's where you bring up the second question about the politics. Are we getting some of the recipe we need for sustained growth that will be profitable for investors? Well, we've certainly been getting it. The market's up well over 40% since President Trump was elected. The market took a step back at the end of 2018, and I blame the president's trade war for that. I think it was unforced error, but it really looks like they're getting a lot of that resolved, and we're headed in a better direction on the trade front. But the benefits of America being competitive again in its corporate tax code, they are not a one-shot Juanita. They're not one and done. I think this is a multi-year supply-side boom to the economy. And if you get a pickup in business confidence, business investment, it's going to be very good for a lot of people, both stock investors and people looking for jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the president has done a fantastic job. We do know that, you know, there's an election coming up. Do the markets start to kind of reflect that? I've seen a couple days where it's, you know, a little shaky depending on what the president does, I guess, which is par for the course. But, you know, worst case scenario, let's just say you get a Bernie Sanders in there. You know, maybe President Trump has a big flub from now until election day and Bernie Sanders gets elected. You think the markets are going to, I'm not gonna crash, but I guess what I'm trying to say is it could get worse if a Democrat's in office in the White House?
Well, here's the thing, and this is really important. The spirit behind the question is, does policy matter for stocks? And the answer is yes. But we have this little framework of government in our country put into place by guys like Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, where one president getting elected can't just go do everything they want to do, particularly when it's things that will ruin the world. So, yes, the market would hate Medicare for all and universal college education and some of the just insanity that comes out of Bernie Sanders' mouth. But the market is not stupid. The market knows that Bernie Sanders is not going to have enough senators and enough congressmen and congresswomen to approve a lot of this nonsense. And so the markets traditionally have been quite fond of divided government. When you had President Obama and yet the Republicans took back the House, the market did very well. I brought up earlier Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, the markets did very well. Ronald Reagan with Democrat leader Tip O'Neill, the markets did very well. So if you had AOC as the Speaker of the House and Bernie Sanders is the president, okay, well, there you go. Look out below. But that's not likely to happen. And so I think that the markets are going to be more discerning than most will be. They'll actually look through the tape to kind of see what's the real feasibility of some of the insanity that people want to do.
Yeah. Well, what do you see with my – so I'm a millennial, the younger generation. I don't see a lot of my friends investing. The accumulation of wealth, what can you tell us on the accumulation of wealth and perhaps, you know, the younger generation's just not, you know, not buying into it?
Well, that's a really good question because I have this different perspective, but let me elaborate. I think that the top 20% of earners in the millennial generation are really significant savers, and I think you have really a high-earning, well-educated, maybe tech-savvy kind of people, saw their parents go through the financial crisis. They want to do better. They want to be more fiscally diligent. But then you have the kind of middle 30% that are responsible, and they're working hard, but they have student debt, and they have, you know, really, really expensive housing market. Yeah. And their wages maybe aren't as high as the top 20%. And then as far as the bottom 50%, I certainly agree. They're not investing. They're just, you know, trying to find a job and doing what they're doing. So there's kind of this class divide, socioeconomic. You know, in some cases, I might mean that pejoratively, but in other cases, I don't. It's more circumstantial. And so as far as the burden on millennials to be saving and investing, it's a challenge because it's the most important years of their life to be investing, right? You get the benefit of time when you start investing in your 20s and 30s that you are going to get a lot of free money out of the deal because you have extra years of your money compounding. And yet, on the other hand, it's very hard to have the extra money to invest in your 20s and 30s because of student debt and credit card debt and things like that. So I think that millennials right now, if you were to try to generalize politically, they don't, you know, if you ask them what's the most important economic issue, they would not say the stock market, obviously.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
I think the unaffordable housing prices, which have been bestowed upon them by the baby boomer generation, through some of the most selfish and idiotic policies ever constructed in the history of mankind. Those are probably the bigger issues for millennials trying to get a solid economic foundation.
Yeah. The Case for Dividend Growth, author David Bonson on the line with me. It's available at Amazon, I know that. Barnes & Noble too, correct? I thought I saw you.
Yes, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all bookstores, anywhere you buy a book, it should be there, distributed through Simon & Schuster. So it's really well represented. Amazon, it's doing great, and I hope your readers would like it. I think it's written for everyone to understand.
It is.
Young people,
yes,
old
it
people,
is.
That's
exactly.
Kind of the idea.
It is, and I loved your book, Crisis of Responsibility. I remember talking to you about that. That was a great book. Was that your first book?
Crisis of Responsibility was my first book, and I remember doing our interview on it. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and that book did really well, got a lot of good feedback, and I do my second book on something more in line with what I do for a living and also something I'm equally passionate about, which is my kind of worldview of how to invest client capital. But, the fact of the matter is that both books do speak to, just something that is that gives people something to think about that might be done differently than many other people are doing it.
Exactly. Now, I kind of want to switch gears, and I'm glad I have this extra time with you, so I'm glad you called in. You called in earlier. China. I've been sounding the horn on China and, pretty much calling them bad actor. I mean, I haven't been very kind to China. I believe I asked you this in one of our early interviews about China and the president's, trade war. And I believe I came at it at a, this is a good thing, right? I mean, because look, China has, pardon my French, screwed us over a lot. So why isn't it a good thing if the president, holds their feet to the fire and listen, we're going to bear some cost. Okay. Where do you see that now? The trade war, can the president do better with China? And where do you see China-U.S. relations?
Well, let me kind of tell you from my perspective. Do you believe that the U.S. trades with China, the country of the U.S. and the country of China? Or do you believe that there are companies in America that trade with companies in China? See, at the end of the day, the whole discussion is very difficult because there are some bad trade deals and there is some bad nefarious acting by some Chinese businesses and Chinese state-run businesses. But we talk as if countries trade with countries, and they don't.
That's
businesses
a very good point.
Trade with businesses. So my belief as a free market guy and as a conservative has always been that the greatest solution to bad deals and China screwing us over is to not trade with them. If I go down the street right now and there's a guy I want to buy a television set from, and he goes, "Hey, I got a television for you, and it's going to be $800, and then I'm going to charge you $10,000 in the tax," and I would just say, "I'm not going to buy it." I wouldn't go, "Oh my God, here's $10,800. I can't believe how bad I got screwed over." And that's my decision as an economic actor to not engage in a transaction that I don't think is in my best interest.
Yeah, makes sense.
So why do we change the rules when we start talking about global trade? If we believe in free exchange, then anyone engaging in the exchange, if it's free, by definition believes it to be in their best interest. Now, maybe some of the terms we wish were better and we want them to do this different or that different, but at the end of the day, we wouldn't do the deal if we didn't think it was in our best interest, us or we being that American business or American company that's doing it. Now, where there's a big problem that Trump is doing a lot to fix, and I'm very confident is going to come out improved upon in this final China trade deal, is the intellectual property theft that takes place. And I think that there should be measures against it. There should be sanctions taken against the companies that are doing it. But at the end of the day, it's very hard to answer the question when I agree with your premise that there's a lot of Chinese businesses and state-run actors that have done bad things. I would rather, by the way, talk about China for their own human rights violations. That bothers me significantly more. If they give bad terms to an American business, the American business has no obligation to transact with them. And so at the end of the day, I think we're going to get a good trade deal out of it. I think on the margins, it'll make things better. But I think that tariffs were attacks on Americans, and that it did a lot of bad to Trump's cause of a growing economy. It made a lot of businesses slow down, and it caused a real stutter in American business confidence. And that was not the tactic I would have taken if I was a president.
Gotcha. All right, David Bahnsen, he's got a new book out, The Case for Dividend Growth. He's also on Twitter, at David Bahnsen. He's a managing partner and founder of the Bahnsen Group. Last question, what did you think about Tiger's win?
I cried. It was unbelievable. I am a huge golf fan and a huge Tiger fan. And also, I am a huge believer in stories of redemption. And Tiger's win on Sunday was something that none of us should ever forget. Absolutely glorious moment.
It was inspiring. It really was. I mean, it was truly inspiring. David Bahnsen, I appreciate having you back. We'll have to do this again. But let's not wait for your third book to come out.
All right. That's a deal.
All right. David Bahnsen, The Case for Dividend Growth. You can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. He is a managing partner and founder of the Bahnsen Group. And he's also at Twitter, at David Bahnsen. We appreciate him coming on. So, hey, listen. The book's like easy to read. Great book. Appreciate him. Hey, when we come back, 2020 candidate on the Democrat side coming to the Central Valley. Yeah. You'll never guess who it is. You probably already know. But I'll remind you. But this 2020 presidential candidate is coming to the Central Valley. I'll let you know here when we come back here on the Guillermo Moreno Show on the new Talk Radio 1680 KGED.